This is Positive Parenting. Parenting expertise and advice from best-selling parenting author and national newspaper columnist, Mr. Dad, Armin Brott.
Hello and welcome to today's Positive Parenting Show. I'm Armin Brott. Kim Bearden is a teacher, but not just a regular teacher. During a career that has spanned three decades, Kim has taught more than 2,000 students and has been involved in nearly every aspect of education. She's received numerous awards for her creative and dynamic teaching style, and in 2007, she co-founded with Ron Clark the Ron Clark Academy, an internationally acclaimed middle school and educator training facility that Oprah Winfrey once called the best school in America. Over 20,000 educators from 41 states and 21 countries around the world have visited the Ron Clark Academy to watch Kim and her colleagues in Southeast Atlanta. In this part of today's show, we're very fortunate to have Kim Bearden with us, and she's going to be talking about the tools that she uses to connect with students in a way that motivates and inspires them in a way that they've never been motivated and inspired before. She's also going to tell us about some of the innovative ways that she uses to increase student engagement inside and outside the classroom, how to promote rigorous education, and how to create a climate and a culture for optimal learning. Now, just so you know, Kim does not see herself as any kind of an educational hero. In fact, she was telling me that when she first set out to become an educator, she naively assumed that she's going to be the one who's going to impart all the knowledge to all these little kids. But what she found out was that every one of those 2,000 students who were lucky enough to be in her classes actually taught her something about herself, about the world, about the incredible capacity we all have for love and resilience, and how to appreciate what we all possess. I'm Armin Brott. We'll start talking with Kim about the many, many things she's learned and the many, many things she has to teach us when Positive Parenting continues right after this.
More with Mr. Dad, Armin Brott, after this from the MrDad.com radio network.
When I have an asthma attack, I feel scared.
It's like tiny nails in the air poke my lungs.
I start to cough. Sometimes my parents have to take me to the hospital.
Today, one out of 13 children suffer from some form of asthma, accounting for nearly one-third of all emergency room visits.
I feel like I'm choking.
It's kind of like an elephant is on my chest. A little whistle sound comes out when I breathe.
But while your child may suffer from asthma, asthma doesn't have to make your child suffer. There are simple ways you can prevent your child's next attack. To learn more, call 1-866-NO-ATTACKS. That's 1-866-662-8822. Log on to www.noattacks.org or call your doctor. Because even one attack is one too many.
I feel like a fish with no water.
Brought to you by the EPA, the Ad Council, and this station.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott, and my guest for this part of today's show is Kim Bearden, who is the author of Crash Course, The Life Lessons My Students Taught Me. And you're the co-founder of the Ron Clark Academy. Kim, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Who's Ron Clark?
Well, Ron Clark is an educator like I am, and he kind of received a little bit of notoriety because he taught in Harlem, and they actually made a movie about his experiences there. But he and I met in the year 2000. We were both honored by Disney as Teachers of the Year. And in the year 2007, we actually co-founded an academy in Southeast Atlanta for students from all over the metro Atlanta area.
Are they any particular kind of students, students with special needs or just regular, any kids?
Well, we have students of all different types at our school, like any school. Our school is kind of a unique place in that we wanted to create a model school, unlike any school anywhere, a school that had lots of passion and enthusiasm and excitement for teaching, but also very rigorous and difficult, some place where we really have high expectations for our students. But what makes us unique is that we share our methods with other teachers. So we actually open our classroom doors, and each year over 3,000 educators from across the country and actually around the world come to our academy and watch us teach, and then hopefully take our methods and ideas back to their classrooms. So I know in our classrooms, we have all different kinds of kids so that teachers who also teach all different kinds of kids can learn methods that will work for their students as well.
I know this is a whole different topic of conversation than what we're going to talk about with your book, but what is it that they're observing? What is it that you're doing that's so special?
Well, you know, it's a combination of what we say are three pillars. We're very skilled at student engagement. How do you get every child engaged in the learning process? Every child focused, attentive, really having that passion for learning. Also, we're very big on the rigor piece, having high expectations for all learners. We like to say at our school, if a child has learning issues or challenges, it doesn't mean you lower expectations. It means you teach them differently. And then we're very big on creating a climate and culture that is both this joyful, passionate place, but also a place where we're very big on manners, discipline, and respect. So when teachers come, they watch all different kinds of teachers teach, not just Ron and me. They watch teachers who all have different types of personalities and different types of emphasis, place different types of emphasis on different things in their classroom, but they all share those three pillars. And so they're able to watch lots of teachers and get methods that they can hopefully take back to their classroom.
Are you training teachers who come to work for you, or are these people who kind of naturally, instinctively have these particular pillars and skills?
Well, we are trying to train teachers. What we like to say is we're trying to create a revolution in education. So educators from all over, all different types of educators, pre-K through postgraduate teachers, they come, administrators come, they come and they actually sit in our classrooms. And that's what's unique is that in the world of teaching, professional development is usually done where someone will go to the school and say, these are methods you should use. Nowhere is it done where teachers can actually sit in other teachers' classrooms and watch master teachers teach. It seems like that should be done all the time. It seems like a no-brainer, but unfortunately, it doesn't happen in our profession. So that's why we're kind of a unique opportunity, because educators are able to actually see what excellence should look like and get those ideas so that they can go back and improve. And then we all improve when we watch other people doing what they do well. So that's kind of the idea behind the whole school.
Wow. That's just fascinating. I would love to talk to you more about that. I mean, is it something that somebody has to be observing for an entire year or a certain amount of time, or can you get the basics of it over the course of a day?
We have different types of training. Most educators will come for one day of training initially, and then many will come back, but it's almost every Friday, not every day of the school of the year, but almost every Friday we have educators who come. And they come, as I said, we've had 42 different states at this point, 22 different countries around the world, believe it or not. And they actually come, and when they're there, they're divided into smaller groups, and they go from class to class, watch several teachers teach. But then we also have workshops. We have training where we talk about why we taught the way we did. This is why I structured the lesson this way. This is what I would have done differently if I could do it again, that kind of thing, and really help teachers reflect on the whole art and science of teaching. So, but most will come for one day initially, and then they'll come back sometimes each year. We've had whole schools that we've trained, whole districts that we have trained in the methods that we use, and they're finding tremendous success and improving student engagement with their kids and their students achieving at much higher levels.
All right, so let's switch things around and get back to the topic of the book, or at least the title of the book, The Life Lessons That My Students Have Taught Me. You start off with chemistry. How is it that they're teaching you about that? And well, you aren't talking about chemistry like compounds and things like that.
We're talking about building those relationships with students. And it transfers to any profession, any walk of life. In order to really be able to interact with people, to be able to get your needs met but also to meet their needs, you have to develop a relationship. And certainly very, very clear on I am the teacher, my students are the students, and the appropriate type of relationship. But when you really, truly seek out to understand what things are important to a child, what things matter most to them, really try to get inside their head and figure out how can I connect with that child in a way that he understands that I care about him, I have his best interest at heart, it has a huge effect on the way that child will respond to the classroom. And so, yeah, I share a lot of stories, both things that I did well and things that I didn't do well initially when I began teaching career. And so I share those kind of ideas of these are things that I did, I wish I had known better. But then when I started to really delve into it, you know, I share a story of Jeremy, a little boy I taught, and I could not connect with this child. No matter what I did, I could not get this kid to get excited about learning. And I do a lot of interactive dynamic things in my classroom, and it was a great source of frustration for me. But I finally kept him after class one day, and you know, and I said, you know, Jeremy, what do you love? And he just kind of looked at me blankly, and I said, no, I need to know, what do you love? I've tried to teach you using football, baseball, basketball, music, you know, popular things in pop culture. I've tried to integrate all those things in my classroom, and none of them really seem to affect you. And he looked at me and said, well, I love fishing. I said, okay, then fishing it is. And so I actually went home that night, and I figured out how I could teach a grammar lesson using fishing. And I took all these paper fish, and I put words on all the different fish, and I put washers on the back of them, and I got some magnets and some dowels. I had to go to the hardware store, and the next day I brought the kids in, and we went to the gym, and we did speed fishing. It was like a relay race where they had to take the words, and they had to categorize them, and it was like a 20-minute activity. It took me a lot of time to set it up, but it changed that child's kid a year. And from that, what I realized is that if I can show that child, look, I'm going to go the extra mile for you to understand you, to see you. I really see what matters to you. I get more back from the students in turn.
That's really interesting. I mean, how can you teach that particular type of thing, to be that creative? Because I could say, okay, you're going to have to try to work with every kid in whatever works for them, and that's a lesson you could teach. But how do you teach the ability to come up with such a creative solution?
You know, I think that creativity is one of the things that we focus on our school. It is one of those things that we emphasize as being important. And I believe creativity is something that can be grown. It can be nurtured. It can be fostered. I was someone who was a very type A personality in school. I always wanted to get the right answer. And I wanted to know exactly what I was supposed to do to get that right answer. But as I have grown, as I have matured, but creativity is the thing I learned from kids is the more you expose yourself to creativity, the more you surround yourself with creative people, that creativity actually grows. But even, I think, in that case of that chemistry, as a teacher, just showing students, I care about you. I see you. You know, whether, you know, how was your game last night? You know, connecting with that kid and just asking them things about them so that they understand that you're willing to go to bat for them and you really see them and you want to develop a relationship with them, that's the key. But the creativity part is something that a lot of teachers, it comes naturally. Some it doesn't. But even if you don't have that creativity, you can certainly foster that development of the relationship.
Part of this whole thing, is from a teacher's perspective, I'm imagining, has got to be a tremendous juggling act, because you've been talking about it and I hear about it a lot, about trying to individualize the way that you teach each individual student. How do you possibly do that when you've got a room full of individuals? I mean, some you probably can group, you know, maybe three or four of them are going to learn the same way. But mm-hmm. How do you have time to teach the same lesson over and over and over again in the same 45 minutes or whatever you have? In so many different ways.
You know, you've hit the nail on the head, and when people ask me what is the biggest challenge of being an educator, to me it's time. There's never enough of it. You know, if I had unlimited time, I could do so much more. And even there's so many ideas of lessons I want to do with students, but I don't have the time to implement them, to create them, to be able to do them in my classroom, and it is a big juggling act. In addition to that, you have educators like me who are also parents. You're also, you know, you have your family life, you have your friendships, you have all these other things, and you're trying to juggle it, and then you've got to go home and grade 150 papers sometimes at night. And so it's a constant juggling act, and so it requires prioritizing, and it requires being able to figure out, you know, I love years ago reading, you know, that Stephen Covey book, The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, but, you know, those things are important. You've got to learn how to focus on those, not as much as the urgent things. You know, you've got to be able to say, this is what's most important. This week, this child is the child that might need me to go an extra mile for him or her. Next week, you know, it may be a different child. And so you have to kind of try to really look inside and say, where can I best use the talents that I have to make the biggest impact, the most significant impact? And that's what we try to do.
Kim Bearden is the author of Crash Course, The Life Lessons My Students Taught Me. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll keep talking to Kim.
Bullying is not kids being kids.
It's not about good homes or bad homes.
It's not a normal part of growing up.
I shouldn't be afraid to get on the school bus.
To turn on my computer.
Message. A lock to my locker.
Did you know that a bully will stop his or her behavior in 10 seconds when their peers speak up?
Use your voice.
Hey, leave him alone.
We have the power to stop bullying.
Find out more at bullying.org.
Where you're not alone.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Broad. If you're just joining us, I'm talking to Kim Bearden, who's the author of Crash Course, The Life Lessons My Students Taught Me. And that's exactly what we're talking about, the different kinds of things that students have taught Kim and how she's passing those lessons on to other teachers and now our listeners as well. Talk about the idea of talent. And that's one of the chapters in the book about talking about how to embrace your unique gifts. I think a lot of kids, I guess, particularly as they hit the tween years and teen years, they don't necessarily see themselves as being terribly competent or
being worthwhile. Absolutely. I think we adults are the same way, don't you? You know, I think it's one of those things that we are all so caught up in a world where we compare ourselves to everybody else, and we don't look at ourselves and see what gifts we do have. And so I talk a lot about understanding that every child has talents. And I believe that my purpose is to help kids find their purpose and to help them find their talents, what their unique gifts are. And so I have a lot of conversations with my kids about that. You know, if I see a glimmer of leadership, I'll pull that side of, you know, that child aside and say, you are a true leader. You don't even know if you realize it, but I see this in you. Or I see that you have such an artistic talent, or you're somebody who really knows how to encourage others. And I think it's important for kids to hear that. And I think it's important that when we look at children, we see their gifts. You know, kids can kind of see in your eyes what you believe in them. And, you know, I think sometimes we think that kids, when they're children, that they should be perfect. And it's frustrating because, you know, none of us, you know, I don't know a single adult who was perfect as a child. We were all, you know, a hot mess at one time or another. And so, you know, I try to explain that to teachers that, you know, those kids that push your buttons, those kids that have all that energy, those kids that make teaching a challenge, those might be the kids who might contribute the most to the world because they have this fire in their belly. You know, they have this enthusiasm, this energy, this excitement. And so it's kind of our job just to plant those seeds and to help those children understand how to take that talent and direct it in the right place and to nurture those talents in a way that will bring good to the world.
Yeah, that's a tough chore, though. I mean, it's tough for the teachers to be able to get that across. I guess getting back to the idea of time, so you got to spend so much time figuring out how to teach each individual child, and then you got to spend so much time trying to figure out how to bring out whatever it is that's so unique about them and get that across. I can't understand how you have any time left to teach math or anything else.
It is not, you know, it is not. You know, it's interesting because we've been talking a lot, you know, we talk a lot recently in education about the science of teaching, you know, about these are the different methods and techniques that you should use, these are the things you should do, and that is true. But there's also an art to it. And I think that's one of my greatest fears is that we're losing the artistry of teaching. And that is, you know, those relationships, that passion, that enthusiasm, that way to connect, that kind of thing. And it's something that it grows. It's something you have to work on. But I would just say at the level that everybody could work on is that when we look at kids, if a child does something wrong or a child is not behaving a certain way or living up to expectations, it's just really important as adults that we let the child know that it's not the child we don't like, it's the behavior. You know, I love you. I may not like what you're doing, but I still believe in you. I don't believe what you're doing is the right thing, but I believe in you. And unfortunately, you know, there are some adults who will look at kids with just disdain, those kids that are the troubled kids, you know, and I often say those kids who need love the most, you know, are the ones that are hardest to love are the ones that need love the most. And so, you know, a lot of times told teachers, you know, those kids that are driving you crazy, and I've had to do it too. I have to sit down and sometimes even make a mental list of, okay, what are the things that I really see in this kid that are good? And I got to start there. Because if you have this disdain for a child and you're around that child and you're in close proximity, they can feel it. You know, they know mm-hmm. it. They see it. And some of those kids, they get it everywhere they go. You know, imagine being a kid where you go from class to class and you know that every adult doesn't like you. Every adult dislikes having you in his or her class. I mean, that would have to feel pretty bad. And so it's our job. It's not easy. It's never going to be easy, but it's our job to truly try to see the goodness and believe in every kid. That doesn't mean you don't have high expectations. That doesn't mean I fly through kids. I'm strict. I'm one of the strictest teachers. There's high expectations. There are consequences, all of those things. But they still know that when I implement those consequences that I'm doing it because I'm doing it from a place of love, not from a place of hate.
Sure.
Very different.
Now, the book is structured. There's 17 lessons that the kids have taught you. And I want to just kind of combine three of them because they seem like they're different aspects of the same type of thing. And I'll explain that. So one of them is recovery, which is obviously kind of what it sounds like, recovering resilience. Then there's improvisation and tenacity. And they seem related in that you've got to be able to make a mistake, have a contingency plan, come up with something if the first plan doesn't work, and if the second one doesn't work, come up with a plan C and D, and then stick with it until you get to the end of the whole thing. That just seems like... How many adults do you know that have got that skill? Not too many.
Not a lot of us.
Yeah.
You know, it is, but, you know, I've had the the blessing, but it's also so sad. You know, I've seen so many kids I've worked with that have had to be so resilient. You know, I'm amazed that they can get up and come to school and put a smile on their face because of the challenges that I know that they're dealing with, you know, the things that they've had to overcome. And so it does kind of give me pause and say, you know, if they can deal with that, then I can deal with the challenges in my life. It's not easy. Interestingly, the book had a great evolution because when I first wrote the book, it was actually more about my personal challenges that I had had. I had been through a very devastatingly broken, horrible situation with marriage and how all this financial ruin and, you know, betrayal and all those things. And the book at first was really my personal journey and how the kids, seeing that goodness in those kids and learning those things from those children, that's what kind of brought me out of it. So I think the first version of the book was almost more for me, is my journey. But, you know, I often say it's hard for broken adults to help broken kids. And so it is one of those things that we have to look around us sometimes and see that if I focus on uplifting others, it kind of pulls you out of that dark place. And so that's what I taught the teachers about. You know, sometimes when you feel the lowest, you feel the worst, you feel like you can't do anything else, if somehow you can dig deep and go in that classroom and place your focus on lifting up those kids, it's amazing how it pulls you up in the process.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, and that seems to resonate with a lot of teachers who, you know, when I first taught them, they were in a really difficult place. And we have the unique opportunity because I'm able to interact with thousands of teachers a year because they actually come through my classroom walls, you know. And so I have the opportunity to kind of see their stories and to hear their frustrations. And, you know, and you are very perceptive and that you're saying what all of them are. And so that's kind of why I wrote the book. I wrote the book because I feel like we keep talking about all these things that we have to do to be better teachers, but the book kind of deals with that heart piece, you know, really reconnecting with why did I become a teacher in the first place? Because I wanted to make a difference. I wanted to know I had purpose. I wanted mm-hmm. to know that what I do matters. And I hope the book helps teachers connect with that and remember that what they do does matter.
So we've been talking about students and we've been talking about teachers, and there's this whole other group of people that we really haven't touched on too much, which is the parents. How do you, particularly if you're dealing with some of the kids you've just been talking about that have had big challenges, I mean, how do you deal with parents who don't recognize the value of education or don't support their kids' education or are just hostile to the whole thing? And when you realize that you're the messages you're teaching may be completely contradicted when the kid gets home.
You know, one of the biggest challenges educators have, you know, is parents. But I guess you know, I'm a parent as well, and so I always try. Now, this did not come my first year teaching. I tell a story in the book about just this parent just getting all up in my face my first year, and I broke down, like, you know, quivering like jello. It was terrible, and how I wish I had handled it differently. And what I have learned over the years is that when parents are upset, it's really not about me. It's about the love for their children. And honestly, it's just misdirected anger sometimes. Sometimes it actually doesn't have anything to do with the kid. It just has to do with all the things that are going on in that parent's life, all the difficult challenges that they have. You know, I had a parent, you know, I didn't tell this story in the book, but a parent who came into, she wrote an email to one of my staff members that was just off the chain, you know, exclamation points, capital letters, just inappropriate way to communicate with a teacher who had really done nothing but be supportive. And so, I had asked her to come in to meet with me, and she would not, and then she would not. Finally, I went out and got her at carpool and asked her to come in to meet with me because she knew she'd been wrong. And when she sat down, the first thing I just said was, "How can I help you? What's really bothering you here?" Well, then she just burst out into tears, and it had nothing to do with us. You know, it was everything else in life. And so when there's that misdirected anger, I try to remember that. You know, parents, it comes from love 99% of the time. But the biggest piece is the communication piece. It really is we work very hard at our school, and we show other schools how to communicate on the positive side first. You know, have to have as many touch points with those parents as you can so that we're together working as a team so that when trouble does arise, you've already got that relationship. You've got that foundation that matters. And we work hard to get parents to come to our school, even those who may not have been real involved in the past. You know, I often say that sometimes those parents weren't involved is because they had negative experiences in school themselves.
Sure. Yeah.
And so, you know, we've got to help kind of break down those barriers and make them feel embraced and warm and comfortable in a school setting so that they will continue to come back.
Kim Bearden is the author of Crash Course, The Life Lessons My Students Taught Me. Kim, thanks very much.
Thank
Learned
you
a lot.
So much.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott, and again, as you know by now, Sam Fuse has been on vacation for a little while, and I'm trying to hold off on doing the Parents at Play toy review segments until she gets back because I like doing them with her. So let's do some Ask Mr. Dad comms that are coming in, and they're getting to be some really interesting ones. Dear Mr. Dad, as someone who writes a lot about fatherhood, you probably saw Mila Kunis's funny public service announcement where she says that a man saying, "We are pregnant," is a no-no. As a father-to-be, I enjoyed the sketch, but I think that Mila forgot that men do play a very valuable role throughout the whole pregnancy. My wife and I have been arguing, kind of lightheartedly, of course, about this, and I need someone to back me up. Okay, here you go. I saw it, I laughed about it, and don't worry about it, I've got your back here. Mila and her husband, Ashton Kutcher, I cannot believe that I am talking about celebrity gossip here. Well, they seem like a nice couple, and I'm sure they both have a good sense of humor. But kidding or not, Mila's comments got a huge amount of coverage around the country and the world. So 20 years ago or so, when I first started writing and researching about fatherhood, I think I might have agreed with Mila, at least on the part, as she put it, about men not having to squeeze a watermelon-sized person out of your lady hole. Kind of a funny way of putting it. But when you look at the data, it is completely clear that dads-to-be have an emotional pregnancy that's just as profound as their partners. For some guys, that might even include episodes of, as Mila so elegantly put it also, crying alone in your car, listening to a stupid Bette Midler song. She does have a good sense of humor. In fact, guys go through almost the exact same emotional arc as women do. They're just a few months behind. In the first trimester, women, especially those who have got morning sickness, are generally pretty darn aware that they're pregnant. And they're usually pretty excited about it, too. Men, well, there are moments of excitement, but this early, the whole pregnancy thing can slip our minds once in a while. In the second trimester, women start turning inward, wondering whether they're going to be good moms or how good they'll be. How can they possibly afford to have a child and all those kinds of things? At this point, men are where their partners were just a few months before. They've heard the heartbeat, they've seen the ultrasound, and the pregnancy is becoming more real and more exciting every day. Now, in the third trimester, women have a tendency to turn outward. They start worrying about whether their partner still loves them and will still love them despite their rapidly changing body, and whether they'll be there physically and emotionally to support them. Now, this is when women find themselves crying along with Bette Midler. As for the guys, they're now turning inward, worrying about how they're going to provide for and protect their family and whether they'll be good dads. Many men make big lifestyle changes right about now. Maybe that means spending more time at work or taking a second job. That's not an attempt to withdraw, although it might seem that way to someone who's worried about being unloved and abandoned. It's because we know that a living, breathing, crying, pooping little person is going to be there soon, and it's going to take a lot of money to get him or her from the helpless stage to the leaving the nest and going off to college stage. The earlier dads get involved, the longer and the more involved they'll be. That's the results of my research and a lot of other people as well. It's that simple. And aside from deciding whether to have kids at all, there really is no earlier time to get involved than during pregnancy. The vast majority of men truly want to be there in more ways than just running around all over town trying to satisfy his partner's weird cravings or keeping her hair out of the toilet when she's vomiting. Giving him the tools, such as my books The Expectant Father and The New Father, and encouraging him and acknowledging him that becoming a dad is a huge transition are surefire ways to get him involved. And if saying, "Hey, we're pregnant," is something that makes him feel so much a part of the pregnancy that he wants to be involved and stay involved, fantastic. I know that some of you are going to agree with this and some of you are going to disagree, and either way, love to hear from you. You can drop us a line through our website, MrDad.com.
More with Mr. Dad, Armin Brott, after this, from the MrDad.com radio network.
Salagadoola, metricapoola, bibbidi-bobbidi-boo. You must be your fairy godmother. Yes.
It doesn't take a fairy godmother to tell you that the right fit means everything.
Good heavens, child. You can't go in that.
Children under 4'9" need to be in a booster seat because they aren't ready for adult safety belts alone. Many parents miss the important step of booster seats.
Maybe you better explain things to him.
Booster seats raise your child up so that a safety belt designed for adults will fit and protect them properly.
Oh, that does make a difference.
Remember that 4'9" is the magic number, and get your little pumpkin there safely in a booster seat.
Hop in, my dear. Oh, thank you.
And like Cinderella, you can live happily ever after.
It's like a dream. A wonderful dream come true.
For more information, visit boosterseat.gov. This has been a message from the U.S. Department of Transportation and the Ad Council.
Now, get ready for more positive parenting with Armin Brott from the MrDad.com radio network.
Welcome back to the second part of today's Positive Parenting Show. I'm Armin Brott. You know, for too long, we have thought of fathers as little more than sources of authority and economic stability in the lives of their children. But there's a lot of new, cutting-edge studies out there that are drawing unexpected links between fathers and children, and they're forcing us to reconsider our assumptions and ask a lot of new questions. What changes happen in men when they're expecting? Do fathers affect their children's language development? What are the risks and rewards of being an older-than-average dad at a time when your child's born? What happens to a father's hormone levels at every stage of his child's development? And can a child influence the father's health? If you had to sum it all up, it would come down to these questions. Do fathers really matter? And if so, how much? In this part of today's show, we're going to be answering exactly those questions. And we're going to be talking with Paul Rayburn, who's an award-winning journalist. And the two of us are going to debunk a lot of the myths and stereotypes that are out there about fathers. And we're going to examine the latest scientific findings about the parent that all of us have overlooked. What it all comes down to is that the role of the father is distinctly different from that of the mother. And if we embrace father's significance in the lives of children, it's really something that all of us, men and women and children and society, can all benefit from. I'm Armin Brott. Do fathers matter? Well, of course they do. We'll start right after this.
Ever notice when you have a baby, everyone seems to give you advice? From your mother-in-law, to your own parents, to your friends. But when it comes to the important stuff, like immunizations and protecting my baby's health, I trust my baby's doctor. She really listens to my questions about shots, gives me great information, and she works with me to make sure my baby gets protected. And that's something even my mother-in-law can agree with.
A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott. My guest for this part of today's show is Paul Rayburn, who's the author of Do Fathers Matter? What Science is Telling Us About the Parent We've Overlooked. Paul, thanks for joining us.
Great to be here, Armin.
All right. Let's talk just kind of background information. We were just talking before we went in the air. I've been doing a lot of fatherhood work for a long time. And can you articulate how things are different, the expectations for fathers today as opposed to, say, 20 years ago?
Yeah, I mean, I might even go back a little further than that. I think, I think what happened is for a long time, we were in a pattern where women mostly stayed home and took care of the kids, and men mostly went off to work. And we were in that pattern for so long that we forget that that's not always the way things were or the way things have to be. In fact, so I'll jump back a bit here. If we go back, you know, say to the 19th century, if I'm allowed to do that,
then
you see that kids, as soon as they became old enough to work in the fields, you know, people lived in farms, they worked with their fathers in the fields and in the barn and taking care of the animals and the crops, and it was a very different situation where kids spent most of their time with their fathers, not their mothers. That changed with the Industrial Revolution, and as fathers began to leave the home for work, then we got into that situation where mothers were home. And I think, what happened was, because mothers spent most of the time with the kids and fathers spent much less time, we lulled ourselves into thinking that mothers must be more important. And in fact, as your work has shown, as my book Do Fathers Matter shows, both parents are very important for kids. And we've been rediscovering that in the last 20 years when we were sort of jumped by a bad economy that forced a lot of mothers to go to work. And, you know, we started to break out of that pattern because of the economics. And now we begin to see, you know, some fathers now have more opportunities to spend more time with their kids than they had when locked into that other pattern. So and I think the economics for a long time have shaped what we think about fathers and mothers.
Yeah, so I did a book, as you know, with Ross Park, who's one of the kind of pioneering researchers in the father
area.
And when we started working on this, he told me about, I think it was Bowlby, and who did experiments with rhesus monkeys. And they had these monkeys that were they were put onto a wire frame, and they didn't do too terribly well. And then they were put onto a wire frame that had some soft covering on it. And they were behaving much better. They weren't feeling quite so alienated, apparently. And and so the researcher called that thing, the wire frame with the sheepskin on it, he called it mother.
Right.
And so it became kind of this natural thing to assume mother. He could have called it, you know, horse. And we would be possibly talking about how kids are better with their horses.
It had no gender or no sex at all. It was a constructed thing.
Yeah.
But that was Harry Harlow.
Harlow, thank you.
But Bowlby is an interesting one to bring up, too, because I actually focused on him more so than Harlow. Bowlby was the guy who was responsible for attachment theory.
Right.
And so that was the idea that, you know, a child's attachment to its mother in the first hours and days and weeks of life was critically important. And again, I think Bowlby was a very smart guy, but I think he was a product of his times when kids spent that time with mothers. And sure, if dad wasn't around, it was important for kids to bond and attach to their mothers. But if both parents had been around, they would have presumably done that to both parents. And we, of course, we see that now in the different situations we have. So yeah, both of those are two of the big figures in 20th century psychology. And they really both led us astray.
Yeah, well, fortunately, you're there to straighten everybody out on that one.
Well, you and me both.
So, you know, I just keep remembering that. I wrote about this in one of the books. I was talking about how similar to what you've been saying is that dads have been overlooked and really didn't start showing up in research of any kind on parenting until the 50s or so. And I still remember one of the first articles that I found, I think maybe one of the first articles that was ever written about fathers in research, was called Fatherhood as a Precipitant of Mental Illness. I thought, okay, there. So that's the way we're going to be talking about it, is it?
We've got a little work to do here.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, so. Exactly.
Anyway, so you talk about, you're going back to the 19th century, and, you know, let's even switch gears and talk about some animal species, because there's kind of, you know, some people will just rattle off that, well, you know, the animal kingdom, fathers aren't terribly involved with their kids, and so that just carries over into the top of the food chain, the humans, and it's just a biological thing that men or males are not interested in caregiving. And you talk a lot about what's going on with frogs and finches and different kinds of things. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I think, you know, if we look at mammals, say, which are the animals most closely related to us, monkeys, apes, and squirrels and furry things, you know, 95 or 98% of mammals, in those species, the father has little or nothing to do with the children, except for the obvious precipitating event, but otherwise isn't around to help with any child rearing. But as the closer you get to humans, you begin to find more of that. You find in a lot of monkeys, while the males may not be involved in child rearing directly, they do oversee, you know, what you might call a family group, you know, of related individuals, and help provide the right environment for the children in an indirect way. And then you find some odd species, where fathers are very important. One of the ones that's a lot of fun, I think, is the titty monkey, T-I-T-I. And these guys, when their partners become pregnant, they begin to gain weight, which is also seen in some humans, as you probably know, the phenomenon called couvade, where some men gain weight. not only because they're sharing ice cream with their pregnant partner, but because of various biological factors. And so these kitty monkeys gain weight. In their case, it's absolutely essential that they gain weight, because once the offspring are born, when the offspring are not eating, the males are almost always carrying the offspring on their backs. And they actually need that extra fat and energy to be able to do that. They lose weight at a dramatic rate after the offspring are born because they're so busy ferrying them around. So, again, I looked at a lot of these fathers, these animal fathers that were very dedicated to their offspring, and the idea was to say that, you know, we're not unique. You know, if all animals, if only humans, you know, showed that fathers were important, then we say, well, maybe we're not reading it right. But it's true in a lot of other animals, too. So I think we are reading it right when we say that human fathers are important.
You know, I'm curious about something that sort of become a little bit more popular, a little bit better known, is that we always talk about child development and the impact of parents on the kids. There's starting to be a lot of research coming out, maybe a lot is the wrong word, but some research anyway, that's coming out about how it works the other way, how kids affect fathers and mothers, for that matter, but we're talking about dads. So, I mean, talk about that a little bit. And it even starts during pregnancy.
Women obviously go through all kinds of hormonal changes during pregnancy. We know all about that. And we didn't, you know, men, if there were any time that you would say human fathers are really not important, it might be pregnancy. They haven't seen this little creature. They haven't met it yet. And they really have no connection. But in fact, it turns out they do have a connection. Fathers who spend a lot of time with their pregnant partners undergo their own series of hormonal changes that are equally dramatic. They experience a sharp drop in testosterone. They experience a rise in prolactin, which if people have heard of it at all, it's associated with nursing in women. So It's odd that this would rise in men. And what people think is going on, so the, you know, I like to separate the fact from the speculation. The facts are these changes occur. The speculation is that probably biology has prepared men for a transformation at this time to prepare them to be fathers. The lower testosterone might signify less competitive instinct and more nurturing instinct, and perhaps the same with the other hormones that shift. So it's, when you think about it that way, it's not that surprising that we would have evolved a capability where men could change to become more adapted to parenthood at precisely the time when that's important.
And the brain, though, is being rewired somewhat during pregnancy and beyond.
Yes, that's exactly right. And one of the ways we know that, there's some very interesting studies at the University of Michigan, a fellow named James Swain, who has scanned fathers' brains while they listen to several things. While they listen to their own baby crying, while they listen to other babies crying, and while they listen to some equally horrible sound, equally as unpleasant as a baby crying. And what he's found is that the horrible sound and the other babies don't produce any dramatic effect, but when a father is listening to his own child cry, even an infant at a very early stage, his brain reacts in a different way, and parts of the brain light up and show activity related to emotional aspects of the brain and emotional connection. So, again, there's a long way to go to sort out exactly what's happening in the brain, but to take a first look at the brain like this, of fathers and see that there's unique adaptation to his own children is amazing.
Talking with Paul Rayburn, who's the author of Do Fathers Matter? What Science is Telling Us About the Parent We've Overlooked. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll talk with Paul some more.
Hands can do incredible things. This is the sound of two hands helping to save a life. It's called hands-only CPR, and it's recommended by the American Heart Association. If an adult suddenly collapses, call 911, then push hard and fast in the center of their chest until help arrives. Hands can do incredible things, but nothing compares to using them to help save a life. For more information on this latest method of CPR, visit handsonlycpr.org today. A message from the American Heart Association and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. If you're just joining us, talking with Paul Rayburn, who's the author of Do Fathers Matter? What Science is Telling Us About the Parent We've Overlooked. Paul, Paul, let's move ahead a little bit and talk about how dads are influencing and being influenced by their school-age kids. How is that developing?
There's a connection. The story I think that best typifies it is a story with fathers and daughters. And so what happens is, there are two ways. Well, there's multiple ways we can learn about fathers. One of the ways we can learn what fathers do that's important is to look at families where there isn't a father present or isn't a father in the house and see what's missing. And so the story about teenage daughters is that, in an intact family with a mother and father where there are no particular problems, things are developing normally, they mature at a certain rate, and we're familiar with that whole process of preparing, ultimately to leave the family and go on and establish their own family. When the father is absent, we find real biological changes in his daughters, not just social changes, not psychology, but real biology. So the way we know that is because these daughters enter puberty at a much earlier age than daughters where the father is present. So this is, the transition to puberty in a young girl is a huge, landmark biological event, a huge transformation. And to think that the father's presence or absence could affect the timing of this shows an incredible connection. The unfortunate part about this is if the father is not there, the daughter does enter puberty earlier. That's correlated with increased chance of risky sexual behavior. That's correlated with increased chance of being pregnant as a teenager and all the things that result from that. It's just, now we know less about sons so far, but clearly, there would be the same kind of connection. It just hasn't been
right. I've mentioned that piece of research or body of research to in some talks that I've given at various points, and I get a question which I want to ask you, which is, so is it specifically the biological father, or could it be an adoptive father who's been there from the very, very beginning, or if it's a stepfather who comes in, how early do you have to be there in the child's life for this to happen?
Well, I think this is a relatively new finding, and so I don't think we know the answer to that. At least I haven't seen research that addresses those questions. But, to step into the realm of speculation, I think we can make some intelligent guesses about what might be happening. Certainly, I think it's true. A lot of people, Kyle Pruitt at Yale is one, and a lot of people talk about the fact that another male figure in a child's life can do a lot. So one of the things that when single mothers ask me, what my research and reporting suggests about what they might do, the answer is you might want to try to get a male figure involved in your children's lives. That could be a brother or an uncle or a friend or a neighbor or something. That figure, we think will do some of the things that a biological father would do. But as to whether a stepfather or another figure would help with these puberty changes and the things associated with that, we don't know for sure, but the speculation about why this happens goes something like this. Young girls in a secure family, sense subliminally, they're not conscious of it, that they have time to mature, time to be ready to leave the family in an organized, orderly way and move on to their own family. When the family is in some sort of disruption because the father is not there, the idea is that sets up a sort of chemical biological signaling program in these daughters that says, this situation is not so secure, time to prepare sooner than normal and get ready to make that leap to another family and try to find a more secure situation. So, you might guess from that a stepfather who was there providing a secure family would help delay that or prevent that. But as I say, I don't think that research has been done yet. It's always a little bit risky to try to guess.
No, I mean, it's just a fascinating thing. It kind of gets you thinking in all sorts of different directions.
Right.
I want to take a little bit of a step back and talk about, since we were talking about fathers and the research that's coming out, we know that dads stereotypically are a little more rough and tumble with their kids, and Ross Park had some wonderful research about dads when they're out walking with the kids that they tend to pick up a child who's fallen a little later than a mom would. In other words, they let them sit there and they basically say, they say, hey, you know, I know you can get up. And they do that more with boys than they do with girls. But talk a little bit about the actual differences, not the socialization stuff, but the actual differences, the hardwiring differences between the way mothers are and the way fathers are with their kids.
Well, I think, you know, there are other examples of that thing you're talking about. I forgot who did this research now, but somebody looked at parents with kids in swim classes. And the mothers generally held the children facing them, you know, so they sort of hugging and embracing the way you'd pick up a child typically. Mm-hmm. The fathers most often held the kids facing away from them, looking at the water in the pool, you know. So just right. Another sort of indication of that idea that fathers tend to, I don't know how we characterize that, you know, they let the kid cry a little longer or face the kid outward toward the world as a way of pushing the child, I think, toward a little more independence. Maybe,
well, there's a good way to say you it. Can see the same thing, which I've always thought is a great metaphor for those differences. It's exactly the same. If you go to a park where there's a lot of parents with kids in front packs, that the moms tend to have them in, dads tend to have them out. And it's always sort of struck me as the moms are saying, you know, we'll be there for you. We'll catch you. Not the dads are not going to do that. And the dads are saying, look at this. There's a world out here. We got stuff to do. And not that moms won't do that, but there tends to be a little bit more.
Yeah, I think that's right. There's another idea that I'm sure you've come across too, is this notion of the father as the bridge to the outside world.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this fits with the, you know, in many families, even with all the changes we've undergone over the last couple of decades, you know, there's still a lot of fathers who are away from home during the day for work and come home in the evenings. And one of the things that turned up in my reporting was looking at language development. So this is always one of the most exciting things to me about having children, is watching them learn to speak and get better at it and get more articulate. And it turns out that some researchers at the University of North Carolina looked at mothers and fathers and their influence on child's language development. And, of course, if their education level is higher, the kids will develop language more quickly, and those things we knew about. But what was interesting, they looked at the way fathers and mothers talk to children, and it turned out that there was very little correlation between mothers and child's language development, but a strong correlation between what fathers did and child's language development. And the thinking is that fathers, because in many families they spend less time with the kids, are less tuned in to what words the kids know. So mothers who spend more time will modify their vocabulary a bit to suit the child. Fathers are less likely to do that, so that stretches the kids and pulls them along. And again, this is one of these things with consequences. You know, kids develop language more quickly and more thoroughly. They have an easier transition to school. They do better in elementary school. They have fewer behavioral problems in elementary school. So it's that notion that, you know, fathers are doing something different. They're not aware of it. But, you know, it what a lot of this comes down to is, you know, it's nice to have two parents, not only to share the workload, which is considerable, but because they do things differently and it makes a nice mix, you know. So sometimes the very arcane research comes down to something that we feel good about and that makes sense, you know, which is nice.
You know, we only have just a minute left or so, but you have five kids. You've been doing all this research on fatherhood. What was the most surprising thing for you?
Well, you know, I think that Do Fathers Matter is a resource with a lot of information in it. I think people will pick what they need. One of the things I picked from it is that I tend to be, I'm sorry to have to admit this, but I tend to be a bit of an authoritarian father. You know,
the
time you did this, you know, and I set down some rules. And what I learned is that that's really not so important and not such a good thing. What's really important is the warmth of the relationship between a father and and his children. The warmer and more richer that relationship is, the more fathers will exert their beneficial effects on the children. So I think I've always behaved warmly toward my kids, but I'm trying to tune down the authoritarian stuff and tune up, you know, the emotional connections. And I think anybody who looks at the book will find their own thing that they think speaks to them.
Oh, that's a great thing there, the difference between authoritarian and authoritative. And
right.
It's you could look that stuff up. It's good. Paul Rayburn is the author, again, of Do Fathers Matter? What Science is Telling Us About the Parent We've Overlooked. The book is just full of, as you said, fantastic research and stuff. Is there a website people can go to for a little bit more?
PaulRayburn.com. It's R-A-E-B-U-R-N. They can get some more information there and find out how to get the book and all those things.
Cool. Paul, thanks very much.
Thanks, Armin.
Thanks for listening to Positive Parenting. You can get more information on today's show and what we're working on in the weeks ahead at MrDad.com. While you're there, visit the MrDad.com gift shop with everything you need to help you become the dad or mom you want to be. Positive Parenting is a production of the MrDad.com radio network. Now, go be a great parent.